John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for July 23rd to 30th, 2010. The Arab League paves the way for conditional direct talks with Israel, and settler attacks reach a fever pitch in the central West Bank. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report, as usual, with the nonviolent activities in the West Bank with IMEMC's Ghassan Bannoura.
Israeli troops attacked on Friday anti-wall protests that were organized at a number of locations in the West Bank. Israeli and international supporters joined Palestinian villagers in Bel'in, Na'lin, and Nabi Saleh in the central West Bank, in addition to Artas and Al-Masra villages in the southern West Bank. Israeli troops used tear gas, sand grenades, and rubber-coated steel bullets to suppress the protests at several locations. At all locations, protests kicked off shortly after the midday prayers on Friday and headed towards the Israeli separation wall. In the village of Bel'in, one Israeli, a local, and an international supporter were lightly wounded by Israeli soldiers' fire. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. In the nearby Na'lin village, a number of people suffered from the effects of tear gas inhalation. The group of Israeli local and international activists marched to the separation wall, chanting slogans demanding the halt of the construction of this wall. One British activist was wounded, as many suffered effects of tear gas inhalation during the weekly protest at the village of Nabi Saleh. Troops also arrested one Israeli activist and a 13-year-old Palestinian boy. In the village of Al-Masra near Bethlehem, people marched after the midday prayers towards the construction site of the wall. Troops stopped the protesters near the village entrance and used tear gas and sand grenades to suppress them. In Artas on Friday, Greek supporters marched with the villagers to protest the Israeli wall being built on lands owned by the villagers and the Catholic Church. The protest ended without any clashes. For IMEMC.org, this is Ghassan Bannoura.
Settler attacks throughout the central West Bank, and settlers stormed an apartment building full of Arab families and evicted three. IMEMC's Brian Ennis reports.
Over the past week, Israel arrested some 16 Palestinian civilians throughout the West Bank. They also conducted 5 limited incursions into the Gaza Strip. Israeli troops stationed at the numerous checkpoints and border crossings throughout the West Bank arrested 9 civilians, including 6 children and 1 woman. On Monday, the 26th of July, the Israeli military moved into Ethna Village, northwest of Hebron. They handed written notices issued by the Higher Organization Council of the Israeli Civil Administration to Palestinian civilians ordering a halt on construction works for 6 houses and a barn. On the same day, dozens of Israeli settlers, escorted by occupation forces, moved into the east of Nablus. They took over Joseph's tomb and conducted Jewish rituals there for about 4 hours. Also on the 26th of July, dozens of Israeli settlers from Brekha settlement, south of Nablus, attacked Palestinian houses in the northwest of Boron village, south of the city. They threw stones at houses and set fire to the area surrounding the homes, burning a large section of olive trees. Still on Monday, dozens of Israeli settlers from Yitzhar settlement, south of Nablus, attacked Palestinian houses west of Hawara village, south of Nablus, and threw stones at the houses. No injuries were reported. Settlers also damaged a Bedouin agricultural field in Umm al-Khair village near Ramallah. They damaged crops, cut water pipes, and partially destroyed a fence around the field. Tuesday, Israeli soldiers moved into Qalqilya. They raided and searched a 2-story house belonging to the Undersecretary of the Palestinian Ministry of Civil Affairs while he was out of country. They ransacked the house and arrested his 18-year-old son. Thursday, Israeli settlers under the protection of police stormed an apartment building in the Old City of Jerusalem. They forcibly evicted 50 people. The police are, after the fact, looking into the settlers' claims of ownership. In the Gaza Strip, a Palestinian civilian was shot and seriously wounded by Israeli soldiers Wednesday while on a tract of land belonging to his grandfather. On Monday morning, July 26, 2010, Israeli warplanes bombarded tunnels along the Egyptian border south of Rafah. They also bombarded and destroyed a plastic and iron pipe store in the central Gaza Strip. No casualties were reported. For IMEMC.org, this is Brian Ennis.
This week, the Arab League Follow-Up Committee for the Arab Peace Initiative of 2002 gave a green light to the Palestinian leadership to start direct peace talks with Israel, though it's not yet clear if or when Abbas will take that path. IMEMC's Rami Al-Mighari with the details.
Israeli President Shimon Peres says that the Arab League's approval of direct talks between Israel and Palestinians came apparently after Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas okayed starting direct negotiations with Israel. The Abbas-led Palestinian Authority reiterated this week previous positions towards such talks, declaring it would not resume direct talks with Israel unless there are international guarantees, mainly by Washington, which is the main sponsor for Palestinian-Israeli peace process for the time being. Among the guarantees Abbas's authority wants are an Israeli recognition of the borders of a future Palestinian state, including Palestinians' right to the occupied East Jerusalem as a capital of the would-be state. Also, the PA wants Israel to stop all settlement activities on occupied Palestinian territories regarded legal by international law. The PA says halt of such activities is a prerequisite for resuming peace talks with Israel. Israeli leaders, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, said this week that a freeze of settlement activities would help a blow-up current coalition within his cabinet, which includes the hardliner Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman. Lieberman has repeatedly opposed the freeze of settlement activities. In reference to the Palestinian-Israeli peace talks, which stopped in late 2008, Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak stated this week during a meeting of 50 people, including those supporting the Geneva Peace Initiative for Peace, that his government is not aware of the talks under the leadership of former Israeli PM Ehud Olmert. Barak did give insight towards possible resumption of peace talks by going into saying that he prefers demarcating the borders of Israel as a state of Jewish majority, as well as keeping major settlement blocks inside the occupied West Bank as pillars for any peaceful settlement with the Palestinians. The Israeli minister also asserted on a long-standing Israeli demand that any future Palestinian state must be disarmed but contiguous and viable. In a related news, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, DFLP, refused direct talks with Israel until Israel recognizes the Palestinian people's right to a statehood within the 1967 borders. The declaration came during a DFLP's press conference in Gaza. On another note, the DFLP emphasized on the need that the rival Fatah and Hamas parties should reach a unity agreement so that the Palestinian standing in terms of peace with Israel is boosted up. At the internal Palestinian level, exiled leader of the Islamist Hamas party, Khaled Mashal, said in a meeting with journalists in Doha that some international parties do not want Palestinians to reunite. Mashal referred to the international community's demands from Hamas, recognizing Israel, accepting past signed peace agreements with Israel and the Palestinians, and renouncing violence. In terms of Hamas, renouncing violence would mean dropping the party's right to resist the Israeli occupation. The Islamist leader reaffirmed his party's position that Israel should first end occupation of the Palestinian territories, including West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza Strip, before talking peace. Hamas has been in control of Gaza since June 2007, after Hamas's forces ousted the Western-backed forces of Fatah Party of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Rami Al-Mighari, IMEMC.org, Gaza.
And that was just some of the news from this week in Palestine. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This report has been brought to you by George Rishmawi.
U.S. soldiers have been killed in Afghanistan, 3 today and 3 yesterday. This brings U.S. combat deaths in Afghanistan this month to 66, the deadliest in the history of the war. 2 died today in a roadside bombing, 1 more in an unspecified insurgent attack. 3 were killed yesterday by a pair of roadside bombs. Both U.S. sailors captured last Friday night in Afghanistan have been confirmed as dead. The body of one was recovered Sunday. The badly beaten body of the sailor, who U.S. officials hoped was still alive, was recovered Wednesday. Kabul, Afghanistan, today. Anti-American protests erupted after a traffic accident involving a U.S. embassy vehicle killed 4 Afghan civilians on the main airport road. Police fired shots into the air to try to disperse angry demonstrators who threw stones and set 2 embassy vehicles on fire. Washington, D.C. The Pentagon is now sweating bullets about the WikiLeaks. Afghan Pentagon papers saying they now fear battle tactics will be known by the defenders, and their intelligence sources, considered snitches at home, will be executed. The Taliban has warned Afghans, telling Channel 4 News that U.S. spies will be hunted down and punished. Speaking by telephone from an undisclosed location, Zabulah Mujahid told Channel 4 News that the insurgent group will investigate the named individuals before deciding on their fate. Half of all U.S. troops are supposed to be out of Iraq in just 1 month, but no insurgent group is leaving. Therefore, the insurgents have won and the U.S. has lost. Meanwhile, the war in Iraq continues. Baghdad, Iraq, yesterday. Gunmen using silenced pistols attacked a barricaded police checkpoint in a mostly Shiite Adamiya neighborhood, killing 4 Iraqi soldiers. They then raised what the Washington Post described as the flag of Al-Qaeda in Iraq over the destroyed checkpoint. Probably this was the flag of the Islamic State of Iraq, a Sunni insurgent umbrella group including but not limited to Al-Qaeda in Iraq. When police rushed to the scene of the checkpoint attack and the upraised flag, a total of 3 or 4 pre-positioned bombs exploded, killing 13 more. A total of 17 members of Iraq's security forces were reported killed and 15 more wounded in this sophisticated, multi-pronged attack. Shurgut, Iraq, yesterday, a suicide truck bomb explosion when a suicide bomber blew up the entrance of a military base in the town, killing 3 Iraqi soldiers and wounding 11 others. Diyala Province, Iraq, today. A roadside bomb killed 4 members of a family of a member of the Sawa, or Sons of Iraq, aka The Awakening, former insurgents who sided with the U.S. since 2007 and are now regarded by many as traitors for doing so. Mr. Barack Obama, things have really not changed much in Iraq since Fallujah in 2004. What makes you think occupation troops can do any better in Afghanistan? Now is the time to cut U.S. losses, throw in the towel, and bring all the troops home today.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. You won't see me back there again. No, you won't see me back there again.
Suppose Army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the Army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. On the 29th of July, a court injunction stopped what would have been the first day of enforcement of Arizona's racist, Nazi-authored SB 1070 immigration law. On that day, protesters besieged downtown Tucson, Arizona. At least 17 people were arrested in a variety of direct actions. Protesters blocked downtown streets, blockaded the jail, and marched on the offices of racist Maricopa County Sheriff Jerry R. Powell. Many wore t-shirts reading, "We will not comply," and backed it up with civil disobedience. Tires, tar, and broken glass were used to shut down I-19, an interstate used for deporting immigrants. The entire downtown area was shut down by protesters. One group of protesters hung a banner from a crane reading, "Stop Hate." The banner also circle-slashed the letters SB 1070 and 287G, the latter being the infamous program where local cops work in conspiracy with ICE to enforce immigration laws.
Stop Hate.
The police could not arrest the protesters on the crane until they returned to the ground, at one point resorting to verbal harassment over the sound system on a helicopter.
Killing in the name.
At the end of the day, after a storm of protests that racist Sheriff Jerry R. Powell had to indefinitely suspend his planned raids on all Latino neighborhoods.
Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses.
In anticipation of hosting future rounds of the World Cup and Summer Olympics, Rio de Janeiro police have launched a campaign to forcefully retake the favelas or poor urban slums that ring the city. According to The Nation magazine, a police helicopter was shot down last October during a firefight between police and rival criminal gangs. Three police officers and 12 civilians were killed in the incident. Typically, police enter a favela using deadly force in quick, brutal raids, but then just as quickly leave. However, under a new pacification program, the Brazilian government is planning to set up permanent outposts in the favelas and bring in social services such as healthcare and education to benefit the population living in these extremely poor slums. But police may have a hard time gaining the trust of favela dwellers. Human Rights Watch reports that Rio police officers killed more than 1,100 civilians every year, but only a handful of cops have been convicted of abuses over the last decade.
For the past 64 years, the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, has been graduating assassins, dictators, and death squad leaders to do the dirty work of the elite in Latin America. The taxpayer-funded SOA has left a trail of violence and suffering in every country where its graduates have returned. Hundreds of thousands of Latin Americans have been tortured, raped, assassinated, disappeared, displaced, and massacred by those trained at the SOA. Enough is enough. Every year, thousands gather in Georgia to protest U.S. military involvement in Latin America. Join us at the gates of the SOA this November to honor the victims, celebrate the resistance, and pressure our government to shut down the school once and for all. From November 18th to 21st, we will have live concerts, speakers from around the world, street theater, workshops, and more. For more information on how you can stand with us to end the injustice, visit SOAW.org or call 202-234-3440.
On the 29th of July, at a Ward 1 Candidates Forum held by a number of D.C. progressive organizations in the True Redeemer building, D.C.'s Ward 1 council member Jim Graham showed up late, insulting the groups that put on the candidates forum by doing so. Once Jim Graham arrived, his speeches were long on blowing his own horn, but often concealed the extent of his own deal-making with developers at the expense of the people.
Question number 8. Number of homeless families in D.C. continues to grow, and families are overcrowded at the D.C. General Shelter.
Yeah, thanks to the closure of Franklin Shelter in downtown D.C.
Many other families are on a wait list for service or are living on Mr. Graham. And what are your plans for a shelter in your home if the cost of closes? Please answer this question, please.
Thank you very much for this question. You know, the fact of the matter is that low barrier shelters, such as at La Casa, you know, are very important, but they can't be the whole answer.
Back in 2004, Councilmember Jim Graham cast a deciding vote to close Randall Shelter so the building could be given to the Corcoran Gallery of Art. This shelter was also deemed too close to the baseball stadium. This was a 3-2 vote in committee, and Jim Graham was the undecided vote until he voted with the developers to close Randall Shelter.
Because the fact of the matter is we've got to move people into single-room occupancies, which is known as SROs. I support the mayor's efforts to do that, which is happening right now at La Casa. I support the efforts which will also give people their own apartments, which happened in D.C. Village, where D.C. Village was an absolute nightmare. Until we stepped in and we said, we want you to have your own apartments. We don't want this kind of family, low barrier shelter.
There's just one problem with Finney's Housing First plan, and that is that a lot of people who were thrown out of Franklin Shelter when it closed and given an apartments promptly lost those apartments and are now back on the street.
We're still going to need low barrier shelters, and for that reason, I support the move of Central Union Mission to the Gale School at 65 Massachusetts Avenue. I worked hard to have that happen. It's finally happening. They're not going to 35-12 Georgia.
And now one of Mr. Graham's primary opponents responds.
There was no space in any of the family shelters that were using DC General as a spot to house families. It should be a black letter that we're wearing on our vest, because that's the hypothermia center. So if we continue with double-digit unemployment into the winter, and we have a winter that was like last year, where do we send people who are suffering from hypothermia living physically on the streets? We have no space. So the question that I want, and I'm completely for moving people into long-term goals, trying to get them into apartments, trying to get them into home ownership, trying to create new subsidies to create more public housing. But the question I have is, all of these programs that are looking to the future, why do we close the Randolph School? Why would we close a shelter at a time that we are critically in need of bed space for families, for women, for children, for fathers, who are out actively looking for jobs every day, and they're forced to live in the hypothermia center at DC General? This is our crisis at this time, and we need to find something immediately to do that. So I would suggest that any of these schools that we have that are not being, we need to retrofit them specifically right now for families while we have this double
digit. Like Franklin? Kim Graham didn't give straight answers to somebody asking him about libraries either. What did Mr. Graham have to say about the library situation?
Well, he pulls out the normal stuff that he's had umpteen number of meetings. But unfortunately, he never points out the fact that even his compromise was thrown off the table by DCPL and DC Public Library, and that the fact that these meetings, you can have 1,000 meetings, but if the community's voice isn't listened to, what's the point of them?
So Mr. Graham, basically, his response is, I had this meeting and I had that meeting?
Right. And he's claiming that the ramp is ADA compliant. We don't know how they changed the plans. Last, they were not ADA compliant. So somehow he has inside knowledge. And he also pointed out that the chief made some fire report claiming that this project is okay. But it's clearly going to block access off of Lamont Street, which is about access to about 1,000 people. And one of the buildings in Deauville burned dead into the ground.
Yeah, landlord arson.
Right, and the fire department couldn't get back there readily. This will make it worse. The fire department has never had a discussion with any of these surrounding neighbors in 2.5 years.
This is convenient for those who want to burn out the rest of the community up there, isn't it?
It does make it more convenient. I hate to say that. And it's sad because it's just not necessary. This is an opportunity to increase access. Instead, we're seeing a decrease for seniors and residents with disabilities, and we're seeing a decrease for the safety of the residents living around the library.
Keep it above, Jim Graham! I'll buy my percentage too. I'm giving people $100 to put yard signs in their yard.
Welcome to War of the Trees on WSQT Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington.
There is unrest in the forest. There is trouble with the trees. For the maples want more sunlight.
In a world of corporate domination and utter ruin, whosoever shall have the courage to take direct action against those who are ruining our planet and our very lives.
After 3 months of BP's oil spewing into the Gulf of Mexico, in the middle of the hottest July ever recorded in D.C., The Washington Post is reporting that SUVs in Glover Park had their tires flattened. On Thursday night, the 22nd of July, a number of SUVs in Glover Park received flat tires. Even the head of the Glover Park Citizens Association had her tires flattened. Police are speculating that the damage was ecologically motivated, according to the Washington Post. Do elves walk among us even today, striking out against global warming and BP's oil spill in Glover Park? On the same night, 7 or 8 vehicles in Loudoun County, Virginia, had their windows smashed, though the cops are saying that this is less likely to be the work of pro-Earth guerrillas. Just imagine this. You just spent $100,000 buying a like-new Hummer. You said, to hell with sharing the road and to hell with Earth. One morning, you wake up, 4 flat tires, all your windows broken, and the 3 magic letters ELF keyed into your paint. Your insurance says,
FBI calls ELF terrorism, and we don't cover terrorism.
Do elves of the ELF walk among us here in D.C.? The Washington Post and area law enforcement don't know, but with BP Zorl spewing for so long, and this summer's record heat, there may be a hell of a lot of people who don't like seeing selfish urban SUV drivers right now. I have a feeling the police face yet another fruitless investigation, uselessly chasing elves. On the 27th of July, Greenpeace succeeded in shutting down every single BP gas station in London. In the hours before the stations would open, covert action teams visited every single one of them, removing fuel safety switches, without which the gas pumps cannot be turned on. Some of the stations remained closed all day, with a BP spokesman predicting that they would, quote, reopen by evening, while a few reopened more quickly, and BP sullenly claimed Greenpeace had missed a few stations. The emergency shutoff switches are also used on gas stations in the U.S. If they are removed, the wires to turn the pumps on are effectively disconnected, same as turning off the switch. The difference is that turning the pumps back on requires installing a replacement switch, and these may have been in short supply, leaving most BP stations closed for the day. Greenpeace said the protest was being held to encourage BP's new CEO, who is replacing Tony Hayward, to move away from his predecessor's obsession with high-risk, environmentally reckless sources of oil. At one station in Camden, North London, Greenpeace climbers replaced BP's logo with a new version showing the green sunflower disappearing into a sea of oil. Elsewhere, protesters put up signs saying, quote, closed, moving beyond petroleum. Greenpeace said, the moment has come for BP to move beyond oil. Indeed it has. The massive Gulf oil spill has proven beyond all possible doubt that the safety of our waters cannot be left in the hands of BP or the other oil companies. When profits and cost-cutting govern such dangerous work, accidents become an inevitable cost of cheap oil. What BP does in the Gulf of Mexico, Shell does in Nigeria, so they too need to be shut down or at least nationalized, as do all the rest of the multinational resource extraction barons. Never forget those oiled pelicans. Is your SUV running low on gas? Is your wallet been running on fumes lately? Well, this is Behind Pollution, offering blowout prices on regular, plus, and premium at every BP Behind Pollution gas station, where you can get a gusher of savings filling up that Ford Excursion or that Hummer. And never mind our blown-out oil well at Macondo in the Gulf of Mexico. Never mind all those oiled pelicans. And never mind this burning hot summer of global warming. Never mind the voices that tell you to boycott BP for the horrific things Behind Pollution has done in the Gulf of Mexico. Just keep filling up that SUV. Just keep enjoying that gusher of savings the blowout prices at BP gas stations are bringing you. After all, you never liked seafood much anyway.
Well, DNA is natural. It's the building block of life. And when the good Lord put it together, you know, I think he did it upright. He made lots of different organisms, a complex web of life. Each one dependent on another, and so the circle it closed up tight. But then along came a man and a microscope, and he separated the genes. And when he put them all back together, he made lots of strange, unnatural things. And now food crops grow on the ocean floor, cows that grow on trees. Now the ranchers gaze while their oysters graze on grass that depends on a hormone spray in our genetically modified world.
Most people don't think much about the significance of seeds, but one speaker at the March 6 conference of the Connecticut chapter of the Northeast Organic Farming Association, or NOFA, maintains that seeds are responsible for the development of civilization itself, because food crops enabled humans to evolve from hunter-gatherers to farmers, leading to settled communities and the growth of cities. Ken Green is the founder of Hudson Valley Seed Library, based in the village of Accord, New York. During a workshop at the NOFA conference, Green examined the history of seeds, which for millennia were saved from one year's harvest and planted the next. But with the growth of giant multinational conglomerates like Monsanto, the life of seeds has changed dramatically. When companies patent hybrid seeds, they become private property, which means saving them for the next season becomes illegal. Now, farmers and gardeners are forced to purchase new seeds every year from giant corporations. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Green about the history of seeds, the role of private enterprise, and the fight back in the form of seed exchanges and seed banks.
One of the challenges that we've taken up with the Hudson Valley Seed Library is that, you know, food security has become this big buzzword. You know, how are we going to feed people? How are we going to make sure that communities can provide food for themselves? Food, which right now is distributed over many, many miles, how can we be more regional about it? And feed more people. And it's interesting to see that for some people the answer, they're talking about GMOs. When of course with a GMO, it's illegal, they're patented, it's illegal to save your own seed. So if we can't save our own seeds from the plants that we're growing to plant them again, how is that a secure food system? And how is that a sustainable food system? It's not. Because we have to rely on the technology and profit-driven motives of a multinational corporation to dictate what can be grown and how it's grown. And we have to get seed from them every year, and it's expensive seed. So when I started the seed library and I was trying to encourage people and get them to start trying to save seeds on their own, and I started realizing that along with losing the genetic diversity, which is so important, by becoming more dependent on hybrids and GMOs, that we're also losing the seed-saving skills. So many people were saying to me, but I don't know how to do this. And if we lose the skills, then we lose our ability to be self-sufficient in terms of food production. So, you know, that's why when we're offering seeds through the seed library and through our online catalog, that everything we offer is open pollinated. And we don't offer any hybrids, and certainly we don't offer any GMOs, so that people can save their own seeds. And we're running the library part of it. It's participatory, so that people can save their own seeds, send them back to us, and then we can mix them with the other seeds that come back from other seed library members and then send them back out, so that we're all sharing the genetic diversity and that we're all cooperating to make sure that we are in charge of our own food sources.
Ken Green, you were talking at the workshop about how multinational companies are basically raiding the seeds that are used by indigenous peoples. Can you say more about that?
Well, this is there's sort of a word to describe it now. It's called biopiracy. And it's basically for plant breeding, the more genetic material you have, the better. Because you never know what you're going to be looking for as pests and disease change, as climate changes, as what crops become more important or less important change, it's important to have sort of a full palette genetically speaking, to work with. So, you know, it's not just now. For ages and ages, people have been traveling and finding new plants and collecting seed from them to have, you know, a seed bank, whether it's a government or a corporation. But what's happening now, the thing that's really changed about it, is that corporations have really been pushing to be able to patent genes. And it started with the GMOs in terms of they were actually inserting technology, you know, technologically changing the genetic makeup of something, and so they could patent that. But what's happening now is there's, you know, a lot of movement and pressure from corporations that they want to be able to patent existing genetic makeups or existing single genes even. So they can go to whatever culture they want to where they see something that they think might be useful. They take the seeds and then they say, we want to patent it. But they're not recognizing that it's been thousands and thousands and thousands of years breeding work on the part of whatever culture they're taking that seed from that created that genetic makeup. So it was really somebody else's work. So why should they be able to patent it, you know, as a quote-unquote discovery? Would it exist because it exists within a culture and because of the work of a certain culture?
You have your seed libraries. There are other seed exchanges and seed banks. Is seed saving something that's growing, so to speak, and that might combat some of the negative tendencies we just talked about?
You know, I think on a grassroots level, in terms of home gardeners, saving seed and sharing seed with each other in any form, you know, even if it's just between neighbors or family or, you know, at your community center, it doesn't have to be a library or a bank or anything official. I think it's really important work for communities and important for us to be sharing those seed resources on a larger scale. In terms of what's happening more globally, I think there are more organizations, non-governmental organizations, getting involved in these issues. But one of the things that we were talking about at the conference was that just because it's called a seed bank or a seed library or a seed exchange, there's no specific definition of those entities. So everyone does it differently. And there's something great about that in that you can tailor it to your community and to the people who are involved. But you also have to really look into it to see, like, what, you know, what does it mean? Who's benefiting from this? Who's behind this? What is it really for?
That was Ken Green of the Hudson Valley Seed Library. For more information, visit the group's website at seedlibrary.org.
Stanford University historian Robert Proctor, an expert on the history of tobacco, was shocked in 2009 to receive court papers accusing him of witness tampering and witness intimidation. He was also served a subpoena seeking the historian's unfinished book manuscript. According to The Nation magazine, Proctor got another subpoena demanding 3 years of email correspondence with another historian and his computer hard drive. These actions are part of tobacco giants R.J. Reynolds and Philip Morris's efforts to prevent Proctor from testifying as an expert witness in Florida civil cases. Proctor is one of only two professional historians who testify on behalf of smokers with cancer against big tobacco companies in civil cases, while there are 40 other academics who regularly testify in support of tobacco companies. The harassment of Proctor and other experts who fight big tobacco is the latest chapter in ongoing litigation over the health consequences of smoking. In 1998, state's attorney generals agreed to a $246 billion settlement with big tobacco to pay for past health care expenses caused by smoking. Later, the Clinton administration filed a massive suit against tobacco companies. Now, civil cases are sprouting up in Florida, where the state Supreme Court disbanded a huge class action suit against tobacco companies. After months of hearings and the order to turn over his emails, the court found that Proctor did nothing improper. Florida courts also sided with Proctor in protecting his unpublished manuscript, saying the historian has the constitutional right to choose when and where his writings are published.